I'm going to start this conversation with a little bit of personal reflection. September 10, 2001, I was at the University of California, Berkeley. I was a Middle East scholar. I was fluent in Arabic. I had spent much of the past 6 years living and working in Arab-speaking countries as a researcher in my PhD program. And the very next day, the whole world changed. It changed for me, but it changed for a lot of people. The attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and the foiled attack on the Capitol building led to an aftermath that I think can only be described as one of the most significant moments of the new millennium. I mean, really, whether you were involved in the media or in academia or just even in the general public, whether you were in government or in the military, in this country or any other country, the questions about what should happen in response to these terrorist attacks and this horrific mass murder of Americans on September 11 dominated the next 10 years. It dragged our military into several conflicts with horrific consequences for civilians as well as for the military. It successfully deposed a dictator in Iraq, and yet the legacy of those years are not in any way settled or certain. It depends again on your role, where you were, and how you saw things. We find ourselves in the middle of another really thorny Middle East conflict. And unlike the last one, it is very hard to get a sense of what exactly is going on, who is telling the truth, who is lying through their teeth. This is always a problem, by the way. This is not unique to now, but certainly the spin doctors without borders, as I sometimes call them, are doing their work. And yet there is no international consensus. Not that there was, by the way, in 2003, but trying to figure out what's happening, what's right, what's true, and whether you work in the news or whether you work in PR or communications or whether you work in government or in the military or in the general public, the so-called fog of war, I think, has never been thicker and more confusing. Abby, this affects us personally in some small ways. It affects many, many millions of people in the region in some very real ways. What's on your mind?
Yeah, this has been... I've been wrestling with what is happening there for all sorts of reasons, from a personal perspective with friends and family in the region that I've been, you know, in this conversation many, many times, but feels more real in the sense that we have a much different way of communicating with people. We have the ability with, you know, technology to see them when we're talking to them and hear things in the background as conversations are taking place. We are, as an agency, part of the Public Relations Global Network. We have partners in those regions and, in fact, are having our meeting for the spring is scheduled to be in the region. And so conversations have been happening around that for the last, you know, couple weeks. And I think, you know, if we're looking at the, you know, the way you started this conversation and how we were back at 9/11 and what we knew and what we heard and what we learned and what we saw, in part was, you know, we didn't have the kind of access that we have now. There were not as many channels. There weren't as many opportunities for conversation. Social media was not yet a thing in the way that it is now. It is extremely difficult to be here in the States attempting to find good and solid information, short of asking, you know, our folks that are in that region, you know, what are they seeing? What are they hearing? Their perspective is very different. And, you know, they are in the middle of it. So they're seeing things, you know, firsthand. I believe and trust what they're telling me is as truthful. But perception, of course, is a lot of what comes into it and what we're hearing here in the States, what we are able to find out based on, you know, any kind of search. It's very difficult to decipher what you think is the truth. And as you need this information to make decisions, it becomes increasingly more difficult to be smart about the decisions that you want to make. And I feel like this is going to be an opportunity in a handful of years to reflect back And just much like you just did, looking back at the time around 9/11, that we look at the last, you know, couple years of conflict in that part of the world, and looking at it from the lens of, you know, cultural components, economic components, certainly the geopolitical discussion. But the base for all of that is really the information exchange and who is telling us, what are they telling us, where is it being reported, what is our responsibility as consumers of this information to seek out as many thoughtful voices as we can, the responsibility of those that are issuing this information, both from official channels, you know, State Department, the embassies, our administration, those that are responsible for reporting it are trying to, you know, go through and sift through actual comments that are, you know, based in fact, those things that are opinion, which we all have one, and really how do we bring forth that information? And then we layer that on, again, with the sort of the personal viewpoint and, you know, what we, I personally, those that are, you know, colleagues and family and friends that are in it, actually down on, you know, on the ground in this environment. And it's mind-boggling. It's extremely unsettling. It is kind of taking up an awful lot of space in my brain and in my heart, trying to figure out what to do with it all. And I, this, we're not going to have an answer in this conversation today about what I do with all of that, those feelings, but it feels like it's worthy of a discussion. And if nothing more, you know, the topic or our, the name of this podcast, you know, is Copper State of Mind. Abby, what's on your mind? This is what has been front and center for the last couple of weeks, is really more so maybe than ever before.
There's a couple of things I think I could add to our conversation, Abby, you and I talking to each other, but also the conversation that folks are listening over our shoulders here, to provide maybe a different set of perspectives. I don't know if this is going to be helpful or not, but it does occur to me something that ties together a lot of what we talk about here with the media, the news, and then these kind of geopolitical events. I think there's something that would be really helpful for everyone to understand. And that is, you may have heard people throw around the word nationalism, whether it's in the context of, you know, a patriotic American nationalism or a Jewish nationalism in the state of Israel, an Iranian nationalism. There's many different kinds of nationalisms. One of the things I don't think is commonly known outside the circles of people who study these things is the role of the media in creating nationalisms. It's no accident that the early leaders with the idea to start a republic in this country, to break away from Britain and start an independent American government, published newspapers. Benjamin Franklin, for example, was a prolific writer and publisher, sometimes in his own name, sometimes as a pseudonym, and many, many others. It's also no accident that one of the first things that happens after World War I, as many of these countries in what we now call the Middle East, including Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, many of the first activities involve starting national media and beginning to use that media to put forth a narrative, not always accurate, but one that forwards the story we're trying to tell ourselves about ourselves. There's a scholar of nationalisms who made the very interesting insight that maybe the newspaper itself played an important role in the consciousness of people that we now tie to nationalism, because you had multiple events from different places lined up on a page side by side in different columns. He called this simultaneity. The fact that you could think of something happening in California and something happening in New York as part of the same story of our country may have been a mechanical function of the way the words were on the page. Now, in this era, we are seeing many competing narratives, some of them overtly nationalist in their tone. People trying to impose a certain worldview and using the media to do that. In our own country, for example, we have the president, the cabinet, using their own pulpit to try to shape the narrative. The spokesperson for the White House has a particular point of view. They've all chastised reporters for reporting in various ways. So this attempt to shape and spin the narrative is something that has a long history and is tied to some of the geopolitical conflict itself. I think that's part of what I wanted to add to this. In other words, the newspapers and television stories are not neutral. Although they may be attempting to be objective reporting, they are also part of the bigger project that's unfolding here. And that's gotten really, really messy in the past few years.
Messy and virtually impossible to sort through. You know, I've been trying to find information. I'm trying to find out, you know, is it safe in that part of the world? Is it okay to travel there? Do I need to make changes to a potential trip I have planned? You know, what can I do? Like, where can I find information to help me do that? And the obvious sources are not feeling as obvious to me. And that not necessarily a criticism of that, but, you know, it's an ongoing and moving and ever-changing story. So, you know, you are looking at noon on a Monday for information, but it might only be updated as far as, you know, Friday at noon. Well, that's 3 days old. That might not be good enough. You know, a lot of things can change. A lot of things can change 3 days from now, right? So even if I got today's information, is it going to be worth making the decision about? And, you know, resources are limited, both from a financial perspective as well as the human resources that are out there trying to get this information. And I consider myself a smart consumer of news. I read a variety of different publications. I listen to and watch a variety of different news outlets. I attempt to find more than one place if I read something to see if it in fact is true. And that's getting harder and harder to be able to figure that out. And again, I consider myself a smart consumer. And I find myself going down the rabbit hole of a particular topic until I realize that this cannot possibly be truthful. Like, it just, there's a point where you start to feel like this can't be real. This really can't be. But is it? Okay, well, let's try another place to find it. And it's, decisions are being made, and I'm not even talking about those that are impacting the war in the Middle East right now, or the conflict in the Middle East right now. I'm just, like, day-to-day decisions that, you know, a public relations agency based in Phoenix, Arizona is trying to figure out, you know, how are we counseling clients who may have an interest in those part of the world? How do we advise anyone that might be dealing with individuals with, you know, mental health issues that are hearing about all these tragedies that are happening? Or, I mean, just name it. There's an issue happening, rising gas prices, the tariffs. You pick something and it's all there. And, you know, much like I felt during, you know, we all felt during the early days of the pandemic, we don't have a playbook for this stuff. We have to, you know, make it up as we go, hope we're making the right decisions, learn from what we do and say, and alter it, you know, as we move forward. Sadly, I think we've had a little more experience maybe in dealing with this particular topic, and that it's not new in that part of the world, but it is certainly an enhanced awareness that we might not have had in previous conflicts. I'm trying to pick my words carefully here, but simply because we just have so much more to sort through and so much more information, and your definition of nationalism and how that comes about, and whether it's a positive or a negative sounding term. I mean, you know, we should take pride in our country. Yet nationalism may not be seen as a positive at all times. And so it's a lot. It's a lot. And you know, I so respect your opinion about it, having, you know, spent significant time there, as well as, you know, this just the study of what all that looks like. And, you know, knowing some of these friends that, you know, you're acquainted with these same folks. And, you know, it's hard to have that, you know, and separate the personal and the feelings that you have about what's happening there from a personal perspective versus finding smart, credible information to help guide some decision making.
The other aspect of this that I think most people in this country are less familiar with than people in other places are the specific histories that have unfolded and the various entanglements involving the United States, Britain, and France primarily in the 20th century evolution of states in the region. This is a place where there were not what you would call countries now until after World War I, although there were movements to try to create them. The Zionist movement began in Europe in the 19th century, trying to articulate a case for a Jewish homeland somewhere. Certainly within the region, you had what we would now call kind of pioneers of early nationalisms, particularly in places like Egypt that had a distinct historical presence and depth to it. But also as the dust of World War I settled and various elite groups began to scramble to try to get a piece of this new whatever it was going to be, the Ottoman Empire had ended for most of the Middle East, the Qajar Empire had ended in what we now call Iran and the Central Asian republics. And there were people who stepped forward with a claim to uniqueness and leadership that at some level we would say, well, that's great. You know, you had Mustafa Kemal in Turkey who said, hey, Turkey should become its own independent modern state. I will be the leader. And we should model ourselves on Europe. And Reza Shah, the Pahlavi family in Iran, did the same thing. So Iran and Turkey adopted in the 1920s a very European approach to building a modern nation state. They imposed that on people in those countries. Everyone was required to wear European style clothing. They could not wear traditional tribal or Islamic style clothing. And that created its own set of resentments. We can't walk through the whole history of all of these places, but it's important to know that the interventions of Europe, the people within the region trying to act like Europe, and then the rise within them of various kinds of disaffected groups who felt they weren't being represented, whether they were religious groups or they were Marxists or communists or students or feminists, there's always been dissent. And that dissent has usually been treated with a very heavy hand. As we have seen prior to this, I'm going to say massively tongue-in-cheek excursion of ours, there were protests in Tehran where a young generation was asking for freedom from the autocratic Islamist rulers that took power in 1979. We might say, oh, we like those kind of folks. We want to be pro-democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you don't get to a democratic outcome with missiles and bombs, but that's a separate story. Why am I saying all this? There's a complexity to the lived experience in the region. You've alluded anyway to part of it. Friends in Israel who are experiencing life in a very contentious environment. And of course, there are people in other places who are being massively affected. And I don't want to be euphemistic here. I mean, some of them are suffering, some of them are dead. Like, there's a lot of carnage happening. And it is a multidimensional conflict in its own right, instigated in the sense of we took the first actions by the United States and Israel, but then involving counteractions from Iran and its proxies, from some of the Gulf states, the current conflict unfolding in southern Lebanon. It's all, as someone who has studied this part of the world for most and lived in that part of the world for much of my adult life, this is deeply, deeply unsettling on so many levels. And we simply don't have the awareness to sort through. So in addition to not having good information, I don't think we have good core understanding that would help us sort through. You know, it's not about who's right or who's wrong, because sometimes there's more than one thing that are true at the same time. It is about trying to make sense of an entanglement none of us directly asked for that seems to have the involvement of many different interests, whether they are big oil or, you know, a kind of long-standing desire of some parts of the American leadership to have regime change in Iran. I mean, that's been a thing since the Islamic Revolution of 1979, when they, you know, Iran used to be our ally in the region prior to that. And we could talk more about that in a different context. I think there's some very interesting dynamics that have unfolded there, but this is probably not the place to do that. Then Iraq was our ally. After that, we backed Iraq. One thing I will say just to end this kind of rambling, not quite history lesson is I think people should pay attention to the war that almost nobody talks about, which is what happened between Iraq and Iran from 1980 to 1988. It was one of the ugliest, most consequential wars of the 20th century. More civilians died in that conflict than died in others put together. It involved chemical weapons, biological weapons, and these were those a Shia majority country of Iran and a Sunni majority country of Iraq with a largeable Shia population. This is getting into Muslim sects. We don't have to talk about that. But this conflict did not end well. Nobody won. After 8 years, they just decided to stop. I think we make a mistake by not understanding what has happened in the past when other people, in this case, Saddam Hussein's armies were funded and armed by the United States. And it didn't end well for anybody. I think 1.5 million civilians died in that conflict. Let's be mindful of what has happened in the past. Let's not be too exuberant for any, you know, sort of, what do they call it? Kinetic action. And the bigger question is, what do we do? How do we live when we know things are happening, sometimes in our name, sometimes without our input, and none of it seems to make any sense. None of it looks good for anybody. I don't have a good way to end this except to say I'm deeply unsettled by all of it.
Well, so from that perspective and with all of that knowledge that you've gleaned from your studies and from living there, but you also played an important role when you were there as you were a spokesperson. You were managing communications on behalf of an organization, telling the world what was happening based on the perspective of your organization and what you wanted the world to know about what was happening there. And I think that's where, you know, from where I keep, like, I want to understand all sides of a particular issue, whether it's this or anything else. I want to make my own educated opinion about something. I want to be able to have that opinion. I want to be able to express it. I want to debate it, argue it, agree with it, whatever it is. But it's not ever going to be the same because it's your personal perspective based on what you know because of what your life experience is what you were there. So I think you come to this with a really interesting viewpoint in that you were in these places when other conflicts were happening and you were there and responsible for sharing information. And so to that extent, you know, my question to you is, knowing what you know and understanding what all of this is about and having been responsible for, you know, sharing out information, how do you tell someone like me that's trying to find the place to, I'm never going to have it settled. Like I'm not going to be, oh, magic. Okay, great. I'm done. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But how, you know, how do we be smart? How do we do this as objectively as we possibly can to be able to find good quality information, to be able to then have an educated opinion instead of being responsible for sharing other non-confirmed, unreliable sources when it's becoming increasingly more difficult to tell the difference?
That's a very valid question. And I'm afraid I only have a somewhat partial and complicated answer. And what I would do here is point to different approaches to understanding and what's valid or useful about them. So the first thing is, during the time I was in academia, there was for the first time an attempt to do non-nationalist, non-biased histories of the region. And why this mattered, by the way, was prior to the, let's say, from the late 80s through to the mid 2000s, a graduate student at an American university would only have to learn one language in order to get her PhD in, let's say, history of the Middle East. And so if she learned Hebrew, she would work in the archives that were available in Israel. Not all the archives in Israel are available. Some of them are classified. Some of the military archives are classified. But then she would do her work using the Hebrew language sources and then tying in the English stuff that she could already read, the British documents, the American correspondence, et cetera, and then would tell part of the story based on that work. Someone who had learned Ottoman Turkish could work in one of those places and read those sources. Somebody who had learned modern Arabic would use newspapers and other contemporary 20th century sources, but they couldn't read the Ottoman stuff and they couldn't read anything that was written in Persian, et cetera, et cetera. So what changed in American universities was professors began to require their students to be able to do their scholarship in more than one language, which meant that comparative histories and social sciences became the norm. This unlocked a lot of useful understanding because now things were more integrated. Now it wasn't just telling the story we got from the early Yeshuv, the early Zionist archives that were preserved and made available in Israel. We could also compare them with what the Arabs in Jordan, who had been meeting with these people, were saying at the same time. So you get interesting works. They get called revisionist history, but only because they're not fitting into those nationalistic cookie cutter molds. So Avi Schleim, an Israeli historian at Oxford, wrote an incredible book in this tradition early on called Collusion Across the Jordan, in which he documented the meetings that were being had between the Zionist leaders who were trying to form the state of Israel and the Hashemite leaders who were trying to form the kingdom of Jordan. And they were working together to try to sort this out. And that story had never been told before. So that's useful. So good histories can help you understand some of the evolution of where we are now. Good journalism should help us understand contemporary events. And I won't go on as long as I did about the history here, except to say that I'm afraid that the era of really skilled, experienced foreign correspondents may be dwindling, if not already gone. I had the wonderful pleasure to work for Christopher Dickey, the late Christopher Dickey, who had reported for the Washington Post in the 80s on the ugly wars in Central America, was the Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor. And when I was reporting for Newsweek, prior to that humanitarian spokesperson stuff, he was essentially, it was like crash course in how you do this kind of thinking. His sources, his relationships, everything was incredible. I don't know that we have the equivalent of a Christopher Dickey now. And I don't know that any of our newsrooms have the funding to allow that career path to develop. So where would I look? It gets some people raise their eyebrows at it, but Al Jazeera has consistently been a source that attempts to do objective reporting from the region. And you have to understand there's going to be some overlay of bias, but the reporting is still accurate. What they choose to focus on may have some bias, but the reporting itself is considered to be accurate. BBC World continues to be accurate, et cetera, et cetera. So are there sources? Yes, the international news outlets probably would be where I would look. Agence France-Presse, which is the equivalent, AFP is the equivalent of our Associated Press. They're going to have people, it's a wire service, so they're going to have people trying to break the stories on these fronts. I would look to them. Then you have the larger question of, well, what do we make in this country of our own media landscape? You know, we've got a president who stays up all night posting, you know, let's be honest, rants on, you know, the Truth Social platform, an ironic name. We've got the Secretary of Defense, who wants to be called the Secretary of War, who, you know, uses the bully pulpit to berate photojournalists for taking unflattering pictures of him. I mean, it's just all so not normal that I don't really know what to tell you. And then, of course, as you rightly pointed out, and I'll just end with this. I used to teach a class at Berkeley. I taught it for almost 11 years on kind of general orientation to the Middle East. And I started the class every semester with the same little speech, which is, look, there's 150 students in the room. Some of you are coming in with very particular ideas that you already hold to be true because you were raised in one of the three major religions of the region, Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. You maybe even grew up in a country that we're going to be talking about in this class, or you grew up in the United States, but went on trips or school trips or, you know, all these things, right? Or you know nothing about it except for whatever sort of biased, prejudiced, racist ideas were floating around about the Arabs or the Jews or whatever, right? So everybody's coming in with something. And the challenge is, I don't want you to think my point of view is the point of view. You're not being graded in my class back then on whether or not you agree with me. But what I do have access to is objective, thorough scholarship from very serious people who have grappled with these issues. So I'm going to give you some things to read. and we will have these discussions. And at the end of it, you're welcome to continue to think whatever you want about who's right, who's wrong, what should happen, etc. I will have done my job if I've loosened the grip of your preconceived ideas enough that you can look at them and decide if you want to keep them or not. And I think we have to take that approach here. I'm never going to convince somebody who's, for any number of perfectly valid reasons, more inclined to support Israel than one of the other countries, right? Hey, that's a valid position to hold in this world. I am equally never going to convince a young Iranian student in Los Angeles whose family fled Iran in 1979 that the religious authority of the mullahs is the right system for Iran. They're never going to take that point of view because of their own personal unique perspective, just as they would probably not agree with someone their exact same age who's currently protesting in the streets of Tehran. So it's all multidimensional. There is no the truth about it. And hopefully understanding that has us all pause for a second and ask ourselves, are we sure we want to continue this hardline approach? Maybe we should listen to more people. Maybe we should talk to our neighbors. Maybe we should, you know, find what the human side of the story is. At the end of the day, that's the only thing I've found that has allowed me to continue to move through a very conflicted region with a degree of empathy and grace for everybody, even when I don't agree necessarily with any of them. I think that's the only way to think about it.
And I think that's, you know, it probably perfectly summarizes my question, right? Is there's room in all of this for each of us to have our own opinion. We should all have our own opinion. It should be well thought out and well researched if possible. But as you said, with grace and understanding that it may not be the other person's opinion, and that we there is room for both of that to exist. And maybe if we can agree with that, maybe in the larger context, we start to see some of this conflict, at least in our own discussions, start to ease up a little bit.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Copper State of Mind. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share it with a colleague who might also find this podcast valuable. It's easy to do. Just click the share button in the app you're listening to now to pass it along. You can also follow Copper State of Mind in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app. We publish new episodes every other Friday. Copper State of Mind is brought to you by HMA Public Relations, the oldest continuously operating PR firm in Arizona. The show is recorded and produced by the team at Speed of Story, a B2B communications firm in Phoenix, and distributed by PHX.fm, the leading independent B2B podcast network in Arizona. For all of us here at Speed of Story and PHX.fm, I'm Adrian McIntyre. Thanks for listening and for sharing the show with others if you choose to do so. We hope you'll join us again for another episode of Copper State of Mind.